Hi everyone, my name is João and I'm your host of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with me I have Melissa Benoit. Melissa has worked in near every software development role, dev, test, DevOps and program management, at companies, big and small, and somewhere in between. She's created and run high availability, high quality services for PlayFab, Bing, Cortana and Xbox One, and now for mParticle's enormous data platform. Melissa covered her love of massively scale systems while growing the Bing backend, where she owned the art of keeping high available complex systems up while undergoing significant code churn. Now, a director of engineering with mParticle, she's passionate not only about maximizing efficiency, both in her product code and in her developer tools, but also about sharing best practices among colleagues and with tech world at large. I'm Melissa, and thanks for your time to be with us.
Hi, thanks for having me this morning or evening or however this works out.
Exactly, wherever our audience is in the world, we are far apart. You are on Pacific Coast, I'm in Europe, so different time zones, but thanks for your time to be here. And to deep dive to the heuristic, is distributed power and decision making. How do you feel about this heuristic?
About distributed power and decision making. It's a good question. So I think that if you, generally speaking, have the right information available to the right decision makers at the right time, they will usually make the right decision, right? So I try to give people as much control as I can, when the right safety rails are in place, right? Where the places where you need decentralized decision making and where you need, you know, strong command and control is when you don't have any safety rails in place, when you don't know if your software delivery is going to fail, when you don't know that you can roll it back, when you don't know what kind of quality is you're putting out, right? When a group doesn't know those things, that's when you absolutely need one centralized point that can provide all of the safety checks for you.
Thanks for the examples. You just deep dive for that. And as a manager, right? And then we can go back in your past also to take the experience on the other side, but I want now to focus on manager. You told that sometimes you need to apply, you need to control, right? What the team is doing when they don't have certain practices. But how do you decide to apply this style of management, even if the practices are in place? Do you have other heuristics that you sense from the teams?
I do. So I generally look for demonstrated experience. So when I start with any new hire, right? If I start with a new hire, I sort of know what they know, and that if I interviewed them, I know what they told me in the interview, which is not always 100% accurate to the real life of working every day on a task. So I generally try to, I try to default to giving them as much power as I think is reasonable at first guess, and then calibrate from there. So, you know, if somebody's a brand new college hire, I may not give them as much lead as somebody who's been 10 or 15 years in the industry, but I'll give them some lead and see what they do with it, right? See if they are working, using their power, the relative amount of their power, safely and intelligently, or if they need perhaps to be on a shorter lead while I, you know, give them training or give them, you know, let them grow more experience so that they have the context to make better choices.
Interesting.
I prefer not to be involved micromanaging day to day in my direct's lives. They don't like it. I don't like it. Nobody likes it. So if we do have to do that, it's usually a part of a short term behavior correction.
Interesting. And because context matter, also you make this explicit in conversations with people as a manager?
I do, right? I ask them all the time for their input or their choices, or I was actually in a meeting with my directs just the other day. They wanted to do some some other teams are doing some team-driven quality initiatives, and they wanted to participate. And I said, great, give me a list of what you want to do and why you want to do it, and we will make it happen for you. So that's an example of giving them the power if they have the responsibility to do to that they can show me they can behave responsibly with it. Right? I will let them pick the work, whatever work they want to do for a couple sprints, if they can show me that they're going to pick, you know, show me what they're going to pick, and not just whatever comes to mind or whatever feels right. Right? That's not a plan. That's not it's not going to be an efficient use of their time.
Well, that's true, right? The software engineer inside of us can over-engineer things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very interested in these, how you make your teams or distribute power. How do you maintain the sense of agency within the teams, this North Star? How do you do that?
So I try to have them set their own plan as much as possible until and unless they show me that they can't. Right. And so if they show me that they can't as a team, right, is that they when I give them the power to set 20% of your sprint, you know, product will set 80%, you set 20%, or product will set 50%, you set 50%. If I spot check, well, okay, you're of the power to set a certain percent of your what you're working on. What are you working on? What choices are you making? How are you making those choices? Right? Are you going with your gut instinct? Are you using some data? Are you looking at, you know, your last 10 postmortems and identifying a root cause? Or are you just being reactive to the last thing that made an alert? And so the more they can show me that they're making, you know, the more strategic their choices are, the more power I'm willing to give them, up into and including being, you know, turning them loose.
That is very interesting. And how about the other side, when you were part of a team as one of the roles, right? Let's pick one, mm-hmm. developer. How did you feel back then? When managers give less decision power to the team and to yourself?
I will say that probably the best products I've ever made were when the manager stepped back and said, here's this very high level need we have, figure it out. And as the team, right, you go away, you do a lot of work, you gather a lot of data, you figure it out. Right? The best products, the most creative solutions come from a group with context making decisions together. And so absolutely the teams I've enjoyed the most, and also the teams I've done my best work on, have been the one where you're let free within guidelines, right? There's strong rails up, so you're free to experiment. There's open data, so you're free to gather data so that you can know you're making choices. You can gather your own context rather than having your context spoon fed to you by a manager, because the manager is the only one who knows the need and the problem and the customer. Right. Usually when there's command and control coming down, like I said before, there's a lack of context and information so that the teams can't make the right decision. It's not even a matter of trust. They simply cannot.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Yeah. I can imagine compartmentalizing the information and needs to know basis, very army type of style, can lead to that.
And yeah, absolutely. Or just bad communication. It doesn't even have to be trying to hide it. It can just be not communicating it or not having the right stakeholders in the room. It doesn't have to be a deliberate choice. I've seen it happen accidentally as well.
And that is a good one. You touch in a point that I didn't have in the list from our discussion, that is bad communication. How do you classify good or bad communication?
So good communication is communication that provides the right context without making anybody feel lost in something that's not the context, right? Without provoking, you know, a terrible emotional response or confusion or a doubt, right? It just provides the information, sets the context, sets the expectations in a clear, easy to understand way for the people in the room. Doesn't have to be for everybody, right? If you have people in the room and you know how those people prefer to communicate, it's okay to speak to them. I don't hold that there's a universal one clear and only way which communication has to happen, because different groups will have different ways of absorbing information as a group, and that's okay.
And you touch Well, you touch something that myself as consultant see a lot, that is the emotional part, and sometimes that something that we say raises emotion. And mm-hmm. when that happens in your teams, what is your default behavior when these emotional responses pop up?
So we call it calling someone's baby ugly, because usually, right, if you're criticizing someone's work or you're making a point and you elicit an emotional response, usually it's something that they're taking personally or that they feel they have some personal stake in and they're feeling criticized or out of control or whatever, right? The typical one is saying, hey, your idea won't work, or hey, we have to fix this problem, you know, the service is not running correctly, or we got to, you know, refactor this thing. You've called their baby ugly. That I've made this mistake a lot of times in my career, and I've learned a lot of painful lessons about sometimes you have to call somebody's baby ugly, but there are ways to be sensitive and delicate about it, and there's ways to be blunt. And usually my favorite, clear, open, honest communication. When you're calling someone's baby ugly, you think you're likely to elicit emotional response. It, in my experience, it's called for being a little more circumspect and enrolling the person into calling their own baby ugly so you don't have to say it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. You just I never heard the expression calling the baby ugly, but remember the CTO that I had once on a time that triggered us with, you guys are clever than this. So just to our pride, and was a very interesting one that was very subtle and push us to think. So
exactly, you have to be very careful with people's pride, right? When something they've done is not, for whatever reason, needs a change, and they're unlikely, you know, they don't necessarily see that it needs a change or why it needs a change. The best thing you can do is lead them to the decision and not force it down. Whether it's top down or bottom up, actually, that works both ways.
Indeed.
You definitely don't want to call your manager's baby ugly. That's bad juju.
Yeah, it can happen as well, but yeah.
It can. Doesn't usually end well.
True, but the mirror also helps. It's good for us to learn and grow as well as managers. Lots of ideas in my head. What should I ask next? So we are talking about interactions between people and teams. So as a manager, do you try to model or to create structures to foster these interactions?
I do, and it's very strange now because when I hired my team, we were all in the office together. We saw each other in person, so we had a lot of informal structures in place that, you know, helped us in our day-to-day communication, right? We would chat over lunch, or we would go, you know, everybody would come and have a snack break, or we'd come and talk about whatever. So we had a lot of these informal structures in place that we've been in lockdown now for 10 months since February. So I haven't seen any of them in person since February. So we've had to have sort of a radical shift in how we communicate and what structures are in place so that we can still maintain those casual relationships and those lanes of communication without relying on simple, easy, you know, thoughtless in-person interactions. So we've had to do things like, I never had a weekly team meeting because I always felt those were really formal and stilted and awkward and why do we need it? But now we have to have one because otherwise I don't have my whole team in a room ever together. They never talk to each other, not all together as a group. So now we have a semi-formal team meeting, which is 15 minutes of, you know, me context setting all the various information that they would have heard from me so that they're not getting gossip. And then the rest of the time, I booked an hour out. Sometimes we use the whole hour. Sometimes we use a little bit. It's just chat. You can do some of your work. You can be in and out in Slack. You can pay attention, not pay attention, but it's just talking to each other, to me, to the, you know, to them to them. Sometimes I'm just quiet for 5-10 minutes. Just a conversation about whatever they want to talk about.
Very interesting. I'm been talking with lots of people, right? Everyone is on the same boat, as I usually said. It's 10 months. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I see this pattern emerging, people being for instance, with my unit of consultants where I am, now we also have this type of conversations. 1 hour, we go to Zoom, we push ourselves into breakout rooms and just talk about something. Mm-hmm. And I see more and more this pattern emerge. But I'm also curious, now that you touch in-person versus remote, what other practices change in your daily job?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing we're missing is the stop by the desk and have a quick conversation, right? There's no way to judge if you're interrupting someone. Right? I could always judge, oh, this person is ready for a casual conversation because they're not typing in their computer. They're looking, you know, they're looking at their phone. They're looking out the window. They got up to walk to get something. So it's a good time to interrupt and have a casual, you know, quick 5-minute conversation or have them do a quick task or whatever. So I have no way of knowing that anymore. But because if I ping them on Slack, it's fine, but they usually treat it with some urgency, especially if I'm their manager. And I don't, they always, you know, feel like, oh, I've been pinged, I need to answer. I haven't found a really great solution around the casual conversation problem. Sometimes we do just open Zoom meetings, similar to my monthly meeting or my weekly meeting, but it's just an open Zoom. You can join, leave. And being in the Zoom indicates you are available for interruptions. Zoom is not a great tool for it. Discord is better, but we don't run Discord because it's got some bad business implications. But something that allows you to just casually pop in and out or to flag, right, to indicate I'm available to be chatted with.
It's a very interesting one.
What we're experimenting with right now.
And it's a very interesting experiment. I remember someone a few years ago talking about having remote workers in their physical team. So it was a kind of hybrid situation, mm-hmm. where they also, the person has a camera always on, and you know when the person was there or went down for a coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's type of the same idea, but I also can believe that can be a bit awkward at our place.
It feels very intrusive to me. You know, I don't want a camera on me all the time.
Yeah, indeed.
But, you know, for reasons that I'm sure most people don't want a camera on them all of the time.
True. That's true. Changing a little bit, because you mentioned twice during this conversation, safe rails, right? And related to the power or the ability that teams needs to make decisions. What is your definition of safe rails?
What was the word?
Safe rails, the rails to
that. Ah, yes.
What are those?
So safe rails is anything, be it process or automation. We use it we use the concept all over the place in our software development life cycle. And it's just the way of either stopping somebody from doing something horrifically wrong, right? Having branch protections on master. So you can't just randomly push to the master branch. Those are safety rails, right? You require a pull request review approval before you can land into your main branch. That's a safety rail. You don't give new developers production access. That's a safety rail. They cannot possibly make a mistake that way. You don't put customer PII information in something that most developers can access. That's a safety rail, right? There's no way they can make a mistake. So process is also a safety rail, right? If your sprint has to go through a review, right? If you're a new team, and somebody has to review the work you've lined up for yourself in the sprint before you can start on it, that's a safety rail. It's anything that's going to catch a problem before it's a problem, right? If you don't catch that a team is working on the wrong thing for you know, 5 weeks, that's too late, right? There was no rail in place. That's expensive and a huge amount of wasted effort. So it's any process or automation in place that's going to catch and stop you from doing something irrecoverably bad, right? You can never get those 5 weeks back.
True, you cannot get time back. And if I summarize, you are talking about sometimes reactive processes, right? You have these processes because you know that something bad might happen, or you had the experience that something happened. How about proactive processes to discover weaknesses in the system itself?
Um, Yeah, so. So what we tend to do process-wise is we'll set up something that feels, that seems right based on our experience, and then do some testing, right? Whatever the process is, it'll go through. If it's a new software development process, we'll have people try it out. If it's new code, we have somebody test it. If it's a new service, right, you hammer it with the load test. We put a theory up, we test it. And then it's generally safe to fall to reactive processes unless we do a postmortem or something that uncovers an underlying, like a severe underlying fault. Because usually you don't know what you don't know. And when I was at big companies, they usually had the resources to have teams of people dedicated to going out ahead and probing actively for weaknesses, whether that's in your, security testing is a pretty typical example of that, where you have somebody go out ahead without a specific mandate and just start probing for weaknesses. But not all, right, process-wise, we don't usually have the resource, we don't have spare process product managers, project managers to go and stress test a process before we put it in place. We can knock on the walls and make sure they don't fall over, but we don't usually have somebody available, to do a really deep in-depth inspection. Okay, so we do the best we can to anticipate, here's the new process based on our experience, and then I'll spend a lot of time refining, looking for underlying, and doing postmortems to look for, to do root cause analysis to find root, underlying issues that span across multiple incidents.
Yep, I can totally understand that the context governs the resources that you can allocate, right? In the end, the money and time, those resources that people can spend. But now I'm gonna throw a wild idea towards you, a probing, let's say. What about if we use chaos engineering, but rather than check for the systems, right, as Netflix started, we target processes.
Interesting. I've never thought about applying chaos engineering to our processes. In practice, I find that that's what my engineers do to me anyway. When I talk about being reactive, I find that I can never anticipate the crazy things they're going to do. So if we make a process modification, the first 3 weeks, I would call it chaos engineering because they're looking for, okay, how does this process work? Does it help me? How can I get around it? And there is nobody more creative than 15 or 20 engineers, and they think that you're in their way about trying to get around you in some way. And so usually I'll use metrics like if they're spending 20 minutes getting around me, my process should be saving them 30 minutes. For example, right? If they're good, so that it's a clear, it becomes obvious to them pretty quickly that they could waste 20 minutes or they could save 30. If it's more costly, if the workaround always has to be more costly than just doing it the right way. And so if people are finding quick workarounds instead of doing it the right way, right? If I've made the wrong thing easy and the right thing hard, it gets exposed pretty fast. And that's usually a quick indicator to me that something needs to be changed. I find the best adoption of processes is when it's absolutely saved somebody time or effort in some way that becomes obvious to them quickly. Requiring mandatory unit tests, for example. We require all changes have to have some amount of unit test code coverage. And I got a lot of pushback on that initially because, it was costing them more time. And I did add 1 to N minutes to a developer's change by requiring them to unit test it. In some cases, they had to write a whole new unit test package. And there was a lot of pushback at first, but then as they see their bug numbers go down, right, in the end, I'm saving them actually a lot of time because they write fewer bugs in production. And being pulled onto a priority, priority zero, priority one bug in production costs days compared to the minutes of writing a unit test. And so that feedback loop was a little long, but as the feedback loop started, got moving, the protestations evaporate.
Can imagine, can imagine. I learn a lot myself, and with bugs in production that I introduced myself, and even the anxiety that that creates. And that is a good one that comes from experience. And I just love the way that you use metrics to benchmark yourself. Are you being able to enable the teams or not? Pretty special. I like that.
I love to use data, right? Because it's especially hard when you're changing a process to know if you've done something good or something bad.
Indeed.
One of my things my team runs is build time. So that's easy, right? That's an easy metric. If I've made the build time longer, I've made the build time shorter. If you've done a change and I made the build time, 5% longer or 50% longer, we can just judge the quality of that. And if I have made the build time 50% longer, have I in turn added enough value to the developers that's worth that, three extra minutes out of their day?
Indeed. And you touched the other topic that is open data. You classify open data. I assume that I know the concept, so I'm going to throw this out. That is data that is available inside of the company, so different teams can make sense of reality. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. What if I'm a company that I want to go on that journey? Where should I start?
You should start wherever it's easiest. So wherever you already have a tool that outputs useful data. For example, if you use Salesforce generates a lot of useful data for you. I had one of our sales teams actually yesterday walking us through our Salesforce data setup because we're trying to unify a couple of systems so we can get, we can get an even better all-up picture. Salesforce has great data. It's easy to get, so maybe that's the easiest place. Maybe your CI system gives you data, right? If you're using all GitHub, it gives you actually pretty good data about deployment, how long it's taking you to deploy, what's your bug return rate on deployment, how often do your deployments fail altogether. I'm a big fan lately of the DORA metrics. They're published by the DevOps research that Google puts out.
Yep.
So collecting your DORA metrics, how long does it take to make a change? How often does that change fail? how many changes can I do in a week?
Yep. I think that we are on the same side. And even now they publish an open source tool that allows you to visualize that. It was someone internally to Google that
did. I saw it only works for Google Cloud, though. It made me really sad. I wanted to use it. And then I'm like, maybe I can fork it and modify it. That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, I think that everyone is on that. But then also we're going to have the tool discussion, right? Because you talk about GitHub. How about if I use GitLab or Azure DevOps or Bitbucket, then everything is slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Every tool publishes a different set of data slightly differently.
Exactly.
GitLab and GitHub especially seem like they should be close, but they're not. The data sets are pretty different. Azure DevOps collects a lot of data, but it's in a very weird format and you can't get it out. But it's there, right? Especially if you're deploying into Azure from Azure DevOps, the data's there. It's all aggregated somewhere and it's pretty easy to correlate it together. If you're all in on the same platform, if you're not, it's very difficult to work with. A lot of them are that way. If you have to unify your data, it's very difficult to do without a third party or without writing some code yourself.
Indeed, it's a challenge, but once again, I can argue that will pay off in the long time from the transparency point of view. And once again, to the beginning of this episode, making decisions, having the right information at the right time.
Yeah, it's work worth doing for sure, right? The more data you can expose and the more people can see it, the better. Sometimes it's just a lot of work.
Indeed. So we talk about decision making and we focus on teams and people.
Mm-hmm.
Now a challenge. You have three teams. They are autonomous. They have their sense of agency. They rock what they do. So they have power to make their own decisions. But their own decisions are collide with each other. How do you do to resolve the conflict between teams? Do you push to the teams or then they need to escalate?
I'd prefer they handled it themselves, right? Obviously they're missing context on each other, right? There's a missing context there and that's team A doesn't know necessarily what team B is doing. Team B doesn't know what team A is doing and they're not, right? They're missing context. They're not working together. So my first first thing I'm going to do is figure out, okay, they're missing context. How do I get them to give context to each other? Right? Is it making them share a product owner, making their product owners have regular meetings? Is it making both teams meet regularly for a little while? If I was in person, right, is it just that I need to throw the two of them together in a morale event so they just like each other more? It's whatever the right thing is for those teams to increase their casual and formal communication, right? Because sometimes that stuff just gets caught in a casual conversation. Hey, I'm working on this. Oh, I'm working on this too. Right, and stuff can bubble up naturally from there.
That's true, and that's true. Do you believe that the work from ID dynamic reteaming can help with this?
Maybe. Maybe. Can you define what you mean by dynamic teaming?
Yeah, the concept and the work of ID with dynamic reteaming is that if you have the missions for the teams, then you allow self-selection in a very simple way. There are different levels and different stories across our industry. Mm-hmm. But one of the purposes is that, or what they argue, and I also believe on that, the concept of stable teams is at the mission level because we have people join and leave companies. It's pretty normal in our industry. So you always have an influx of people. Why do not just assume that people move and you allow even people to move between teams?
I think that presupposes that you have a certain baseline amount of, that you're at a certain staffing level for your organization, that you're an organization at a certain level of maturity. Right. It can be difficult if you have, you know, a very bottom heavy organization, if you have mostly engineers with, you know, 0 to 5 levels of experience, it can be very difficult if you're letting them self-select on and off of teams. So let me put it this way. It's a matter of safety rails. So if you have a mature team that you trust to make decisions like that, and that you have safety rails to ensure that everybody isn't just jumping onto the one fun, cool project, that there's a certain minimum staffing level. Sometimes a project is unglamorous or is, you know, hard for reasons that people don't enjoy, but it needs to get done. So I think in a large enough organization, you have you're more likely mathematically to have somebody who will enjoy the work that most don't enjoy. So there's a risk there. And so we have a happy medium in my group, which is if you really want to change teams, you can, no problem. It's not like a formal, you won't leave your manager, you just go to a different team. In practice, some people don't change very often. Some people change every 6 months to a year, whether they need to, or we need to shuffle them because there's an urgent need and they're, you know, okay with it. Some teams are more stickier than others. The teams that are the stickiest actually seem to be the most junior teams, relatively speaking, in terms of user experience. They tend to be the stickiest in that people stay with them. Provided it's a good team fit, of course, right? Provided that they, you know, they, if they can make the first couple months, then they tend to be sticky there. Because they're doing a lot more learning, I guess. I mean, I'm speculating why that is, but I think it's because they're doing a lot more learning rather than applying the things that they, you know, their mastery, demonstrating mastery, right? I think the people who are best able to, you know, go dynamically to whatever team strikes their interest or the mission feels important to them are the people who have demonstrated a lot of mastery, both of understanding requirements and also of themselves and their working process and their tools and whatever, you know, whatever their working tools are.
It's a very interesting relationship. And well, I think that, well, as an industry, we are maturing and we are discovering new ways. Perhaps we will have generating more insights on this field. But I think that is a very interesting concept from the point of view that people join and left. But indeed, your argument about staffing levels, it's an interesting, a very, very interesting one. Because I can see also contexts where companies are just too small to afford it.
Mm-hmm. And we run into this, it's a fresh problem that I deal with often. We're just at the size where we can sort of do either. We're big enough that we can dynamic team, but we're small enough that if we dynamic team too much in the wrong direction, it can really hurt us as a company.
Yep.
So I'm battling this tension all the time. Well, we have this thing that needs to get done, but we only have so many resources, and we have this other thing that, you know, people would like to do, but it's probably not as important as this thing that must get done from a business perspective, right? Because we generally know we have, you know, a contract commit for this, or we have a, you know, a marketing push for this, or, you know, there's significant reasons behind why something must get done, even if it is not the most exciting thing for a given developer.
Indeed. So very, very interesting. Once again, sensing the context as a manager to go these right decisions. Lots of data points at play. And, well, we are past by the mark of half an hour. The conversation and time just flies. So I have one last question. What are the resources that you recommend to our audience? Books or podcasts or blog posts or whatever you think?
Yes. So I mentioned earlier the Google State of DevOps report. I love that report. There's a book called Accelerate that I actually gave to my CEO a couple of weeks ago. That's also fantastic about making data-driven decisions from a shipping software perspective, but it really applies, gives the reasoning back into the business, like the business values of why it's important. What else? So those are the big resources I'm in right now. I think on my Twitter, I've linked a few others as they come up about different manager resources. I'll have to see what I have pinned lately.
Cool.
I generally link a lot of sources out of there as well.
Yeah. So, and I also will make sure that your Twitter handler is on description of this episode so people can engage with you if they agree or don't agree. Let's see how that goes. And with this, we end the episode. Once again, I want to thank you for your time and share these insights. It was very thoughtful to me. Lots of ideas in my head.
Yes, thank you. It was a great way to spend my morning/evening/whatever time, whatever time that you're in.
Yeah, cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter at AskCrafts Podcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. See you next week.